You know, multiple award-winning comedy genius and very tall man, Stephen Merchant. I wonder what he buys on Amazon.
Oh, when I need a laugh, there's a helping people. Don't pass talking to these funny people. He's asking what they're buying and they're telling stories. Can somebody yell out the name of the show, please? It's my mate, Wood Toaster. Oh, it's my mate, Wood Toaster. Yeah, yeah, it's my mate, Wood Toaster.
Hello, welcome back to another episode of My Mate Bought a Toaster. And my guest this week is the rather splendid and rather brilliant. And do you know what? I haven't even written an introduction for you, Stephen Merchant. It's Stephen Merchant. I mean, you literally don't need an introduction. And helpfully, I'm also quite lazy. So those things went well together.
Yeah, it is. It's you're lucky, aren't you, that I don't need an introduction? Because you've really put no work in. And I appreciate that.
Just nothing. Yeah. I like a low-key start. Maybe I'll sort of... we'll try and do a big outro. Do you know what I mean?
Let me give you a word of advice. Can I give you a word of advice?
Please.
You know, as a sort of pioneering podcaster, do put some effort in.
Yeah.
Do put some effort in. Don't just slide into the interview. Think of a nice introduction. Maybe have a posse like the late, great Steve Wright.
Oh, mate.
Just something, because...
Yeah.
Just to give it a little bit more showbiz, a bit more razzmatazz.
Would you also suggest charging, 67p an episode? Because that you slipped into podcasts for that year when it was acceptable to charge per episode. What a time. What a time to be an early adopter.
Can we cut this bit out?
Move on, Tom. Move on.
Come on. Come on, mate.
All right, here we go. So, Stephen, you have let me into your Amazon account, and we're going to begin this journey into your past, okay? So through the mists of time, we're going into the cloud, and we're looking back to your first ever purchase on Amazon. It was in 2006, okay? June 2006, All right? And you bought two things in one hit. You bought The West Wing Complete Season 4 and The Michelin Web Situation.
Now, I don't know. I don't remember the Michelin Web DVD. I love those guys, and but I don't. It's not on my collection, so perhaps it was a gift.
Mm. Well, I mean, it's a good gift. And at this stage, 06, they were pretty famous. The Office had happened in, 2000, right? So...
2001, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, 2001.
Okay. So by this point, are you good at keeping an eye on what else is going on in comedy? Are you quite, or do you just sort of switch that part of you off? Are you always looking out there to see who else is around?
I think I'm getting this right, but before I did The Office, I worked at the BBC on what was then the BBC's lowest budget comedy sketch show of all time, called Comedy Nation.
Oh, wow.
And I was just sort of backroom boy doing all kinds of things. It was so low budget that one week I was costume designer, the next week location guy. And but it had an amazing roster of talent. And my memory is that Mitchell and Webb did some sketches for that that I probably would have helped, you know, position a lamp or something, which was before The Office. In fact, I remember we pitched a prototype David Brent to Comedy Nation.
Oh, wow.
And we wrote a little script called, I think it was just called CD Boss. And they said, no, we're not interested in this. And so it never got made.
This is going to go nowhere.
Lucky for us.
Who cares about CD Boss? The sketch stuff, you went long form pretty early doors, right? You did a bit of sketch stuff, but you just wanted more time for everyone to see all your funny words, right? Sketches are very hit and run and also hit and miss quite often.
Well, probably that's why I was buying The West Wing Season 4 at the same time, right? I was thinking, hang on, got grander ambitions here.
Yeah.
Long form narrative.
I love it when a show like The West Wing is funny, because The West Wing did have a really... Aaron Sorkin's funny. Like, it'll have a slapstick moment, like when Josh sits down and Don has moved his chair, and it's almost funnier than when it happens in a sitcom, right? Because you're not expecting it. That's a surprise.
Oh, it's brilliant. Oh, The West Wing is terrific. For those that have not seen it, it still stands up. In fact, funnily enough, I dusted off those DVDs, and during lockdown, rewatched much of The West Wing, and I thought I could buy it again because it was available to purchase on some streaming service. I thought, I'll be damned.
Yeah, yeah.
Up in the loft.
Yeah.
Get the old DVD player and the DVDs back out.
This is so weird. Right, hang on. I've got to show you this. This is unbelievable. I promise you, this is not pre-planned. I'm in my box room, right? And there's basically a lot of objects that are on death row behind me, right?
Oh.
West Wing.
There it is.
That's literally it. Season 4.
Season 4.
I promise you this isn't pre-planned.
There's the other one. There's loads of them. There's loads and loads of West Wings here.
Well, all I would warn you, Tom, is you will need... They're not streaming for free anywhere at the moment, so you'll have to purchase them if you want to watch them again.
So would you advise holding on to the DVDs? Because this genuinely, there's about four boxes down there of DVDs. It's your Wires, your Sopranos, your West Wings. It's all those things that were staples back then when we were riding this sort of golden wave of these big American dramas. And my default is, well, we get rid of that because everything is in the cloud. So are you saying keep?
Well, I'm rather partial to a physical box set.
Yes.
You might see behind me, I've got some DVDs and CDs.
Yes.
And I've got vinyl downstairs, and I'm quite partial to there being an artifact.
Yes.
And, you know, maybe I'm behind the times because I love streaming and it's an amazing function. But, you know, you're essentially going to have to pay for it all again.
Mm, that's what they're doing.
Because it's not always free. So are you willing to pay for the West Wing all over again?
I'm going to say no. I am I'm definitely the tightest person I know. The other thing I've got to do, actually, is I'd have to buy a new DVD player because I no longer have a DVD player.
Oh, well, then maybe you should get rid of them. I mean, if you've not clung onto your DVD player. I mean, I've got a VHS machine over here because I'm not taking any chances.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Steve, are you running some sort of piracy thing over there? Is that what's going on? Are you...
In my lockup.
Oh, my God. Your home taping is killing film, Stephen. For goodness sake, Stephen.
Do you want to see Mad Max Furiosa? I'll just pop down the Odeon later with a camcorder strapped to my bonnet.
Those things. This is an interesting thing, isn't it, when people sell DVDs on the street. It doesn't, I don't think, happen so much anymore. But when I went to America, there's a lot of people in LA who sell you DVDs of, obviously, they try and sell you hokey films. They also sell you their sort of stand-up specials. Have you seen them when they do that?
Really? I don't know about that. I was in Mexico and I did buy a bootleg copy of my film Fight With My Family.
You're only stealing off yourself. That's fine.
Which I was quite proud of. But I thought that they had sort of, they'd done a kind of color photocopy of the cover.
Yeah.
But other than that, they'd not put enough effort in my opinion.
did they twig? Did they have any idea?
They had no idea.
Lovely stuff.
They had no idea. Lovely but I was quite, in a weird way, I was quite proud that it was being bootlegged in Mexico. I think it's a testament to the quality of the film.
Yeah. Exactly.
When they're looking through your shopping history and they don't understand it, you have been bought red-handed.
April and June 06, you've bought like three seasons of The West Wing. That is hours and hours of TV. So I'm sensing, I'm smelling a binger. Are we a bit of a TV binger, Steve?
We are a binger, certainly back then, perhaps less so now. But I remember, because that's around the time we were doing extras, our TV show extras. And I remember distinctly watching an episode of The West Wing and coming in the next morning and saying to Ricky, we should do a walk and talk in this scene. And trying to get the Steadicam out and do this whole scene, you know. And they was like, well, we've got nowhere to walk. We're in a tiny little office. But I was very easily influenced by whatever I was watching if I was also directing stuff. So now if I'm directing, I tend to park my binging.
Yeah.
Because otherwise I will be easily influenced by whatever I'm watching.
You don't want that voice in your head. That makes sense. And often you don't necessarily realise it's there and suddenly there's a... It's the moment in The West Wing when he goes, walk with me. That's such a...
That's right.
And then,
amazing.
Of course, they've got the budgets, right? Especially with The West Wing then. To walk down a long corridor with people flying everywhere behind you, and because the busyness is part of the lifeblood of the whole show. You feel like you're in the middle of the epicenter, but doing that on a British budget, that's just going to be one bloke.
Oh, you just reminded me. And I mean, if I can do this, this is not even a humble brag. This is just a pure brag.
Yeah, lovely.
I was in a restaurant not about a couple of weeks ago in LA and Aaron Sorkin came in and just walked by and went, I enjoy what you do.
Oh my God.
And then went to his table. I thought, hello, here we go.
What?
Bish, bash, bosh.
That's unbelievable.
We've come a long way since 2006.
Wow.
When I was basically paying him to watch his TV show.
But also, I'd say very un-Sorkin. That's very succinct. Do you know what I mean? I'd expect pages and pages of dialogue.
He wasn't very verbose.
Yeah. But
but he did keep walking. He was walking and talking, if that helps.
It's very on brand. I mean, who would have thought the Stephen Merchant buying all this in 2006, you know, ends up eating at the same place as Aaron Sorkin?
Yeah, I didn't even make that connection until we started talking about it.
It's beautiful. All right, so 06, and we're into 07 now, Steve. The Eric Rohmer collection. Who's Eric Rohmer? Am I being massively...
Eric Rohmer's a French director.
Okay, good, fine. I don't feel too thick for not knowing that.
I was, you know, I like to mix it up. Bit of culture in there as well, boy.
This is all influencing extras.
Possibly, although I think as time goes on, I think we were working on our own film, Cemetery Junction. So I think some of these were might have started to inform that. I'm trying to think, maybe not those specifically, but...
Yeah. Do you feel as well, as you're writing and coming up with the stuff, do you feel like you're getting better? And are you pleased with what you've done? Because that's always the moment I find fascinating about anyone who writes stuff is when you read it back, there's always the... It's a good way of telling how someone is. Like, you either look at it and go, I am good at this, or do you look at it and go, this is, I mean, I don't even know what this. Like how is your, how do you react to your own writing and your own stuff?
Well, I think there's a level of competency and experience that I have now that I didn't have back then.
Yeah.
So there was a sort, there were kind of, there was like a raw energy, talent, ability, or enthusiasm back then that Ricky and I were sort of, you know, discovering it as we did it.
Yeah.
Whereas now I feel like I've done it enough and long enough that I've sort of, I can write a first draft that's sort of a solid, it's solid, you know,
yes.
It's kind of quite well structured.
Yes.
And the sort of tricks, or I should say the mistakes that you make when you're starting out, you've refined those so scenes don't drag on too long. Mm. You know that you can start a scene later and end it sooner.
Yeah.
These are all sort of screenwriting tricks that you pick up along the way. Either you read a book about them or you instinctively learn them along the way.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a sort of, there's a level of technique that you have once you're more experienced that you didn't have at the start.
So when this is happening in 2007, you are on this massive wave. Obviously, you know, you're established by that point. Things are going really, really well. But did you feel the pressure of like, I need to make my mark now. I need to make sure this sustains. I need to make the most of the time because presumably by now you're getting money so you can sit back and write for a few months. It's not like you're urgently having to do stuff. Was that like a pressure situation? Or was it like, yeah, we'll have a go, throw the dice, see what happens?
I remember a conversation where we were talking about the fact that you to try and top the success of The Office, which had sort of spiraled beyond our wildest dreams. It had run off into the world, you know, like Frankenstein's monster. It was rampaging off on its own.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the idea of trying to kind of do that with every subsequent project seemed an impossible feat. Mm. And so I remember sort of us talking about, you know, the only thing you can do is to sort of take a sideways move and do something else that you enjoy or that's interesting to you, or it's a piece of work that you'd like to see. That to try and kind of constantly top yourself, that kind of, right? that would seem an impossible challenge or a very difficult one.
Yes, that's a very healthy mindset.
I think so. I think that's the only way to approach it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You've got your, you know, you've got your Elton, your Curtis. You've got your Blackadder. That's safe. That's in the bank. No one's taking that off you.
Right.
Now that's a free swim, mate. That's a free swim. I'm giving you advice, Steve. I'm giving you advice, mate.
Yeah,
just if
I've done the adder, I'm going to do a dibbly.
That is a golden rule of comedy. For every adder, there must be a dibbly.
That's right.
Or thin blue line. All right. Okay, good. So that's 2007. Let's go into 2008 now. And we've got, there it is, The Wire. We've got Get Carter. Seinfeld, complete collection, £100 on 9 seasons of Seinfeld. I mean, just how good is Seinfeld?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a masterwork. And I think I remember watching it when I was, when would it have been on? It was on in the 90s, wasn't it? Because
I was going to say, it was on about 9 a.m. most mornings when I was starting stand-up.
Was it
really? It was on after breakfast TV finished. And I was just waking up when I was doing loads of stand-up and we'd watch it on, I think it was Channel 4. And I knew nothing about it. I didn't have much sort of American comedy nous. And it was just brilliant. It was just the nothingness of it. And yet there was always something. And I don't know how they played that magic trick.
Yeah. I actually saw Seinfeld perform live recently. And there is just, there's something so kind of immaculate about his stand-up. You know, there's a sort of, there's a refinement to it. There's sort of, and as he himself would say, you know, it's every word has kind of been worked.
Yes.
You know, and the show feels the same way, doesn't it? You know, it feels, there's a refinement to it. There's a kind of precision and an elegance to it.
I'm gonna say it. This might be the most pretentious moment of the show so far. poetry.
There is a poetry mix.
There is, isn't there?
There is.
Because if you've got to choose the bon mot, the ability to just throw that word in where you go, oh my God, that's so perfect. And very few people can riff that and find that just in their brains. Most people, I think, it's a case of learning and writing and sitting and thinking. To do that spontaneously is just impossible almost.
Oh, yeah. But I've just gone back to stand-up again now after quite a long time. And there's something about, you know, I don't think I would ever quite have the discipline that someone like Seinfeld has, who will write and rewrite literally line by line and memorize it and try it and come back.
Mate.
And that's something, that's sort of, there's a exhaustion to that that's, I mean, it's impressive, but it's a very specific way of doing it. I think, I don't know whether, like you, I feel like it's sort of saying it out loud until it takes on and till it works.
To do stand up well and properly, which I never have. You know, I did the circuit for a bit, but it was with conditions, and I was always ready to get the phone call to go off and film something or whatever. But to do it properly and write those big shows, exactly as you're saying, write it, memorize it, chip away at it, find the tiny observation. What's the thing about dusting DVDs? Okay, find that work. Yes. And I'm like, by that point, I've moved on, guys. I'm thinking about something else.
Well, I think I've got some of that. Like, I'm more than happy to keep on working it and hone it.
Mm.
But for some reason, I could sit and write you a sitcom and I'd toil over every word. But with stand-up, I find it very hard to sit and write it.
Yeah.
I sort of try, however hard I try, I go out in the evening and I sort of say it, and either it works or it doesn't.
Yeah.
It's very hard to write it. There's something about the directness of the fact you're talking to the audience, you rely on them to sort of tell you what's working. You find that there's a way of speaking stand up that's different than almost anything else you might write.
Yes.
And I don't know what it is. It's like you're writing one half of a conversation or something.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Exactly.
It's unique.
I was going to say it would be like going on a date and writing down what you're going to say on the date, which, you know,
that's right.
For some people, it's a good safety net to have.
Hey, we've all done it.
We've all arrived at dates thinking,
I've got four quality anecdotes.
Exactly. I've got one anecdote per course and I've got a reserve anecdote. That's it.
And like on it, like any good talk show guest, you know, you can turn any question around to that anecdote.
Talk to me about that, doing the talk shows, because you are fantastic. I've seen you on Fallon a few times and obviously the British ones as well. How do you find doing those? Because those are sometimes, certainly in America, quite pre-planned. You'll get the phone call, Steve, what are you going to talk about? What's your story? Do you enjoy doing that? Does that feel too pre-prepared?
Well, I didn't realise that about American talk shows until I did them a few times. And I realised, this is not a conversation. This is come on with two anecdotes that you've worked up.
Yeah.
So now I will take it very seriously. And sometimes I've even tried out stories on stage, you know, gone to a little stand-up club and just worked the story so that I've at least said it out loud and that it makes sense and it has a beginning, middle and end. And I've got some coming up in the next few weeks. And I do take it very seriously. I sort of approach them a little bit like you would a stand-up gig because invariably you've got a live audience in those kind of talk shows. Yeah. And so, you know, I like doing the one show or this morning or whatever, but you can genuinely be a bit more relaxed and conversational.
Yeah.
With Graham Norton or those American talk shows, there's an audience. And suddenly when you see an audience and you're telling a story and you feel them yawning or not engaged or God, it's unbearable. So
is that the most nerve-wracking thing that you do in your, because you do everything, right? Is that the moment, is that the pinch point?
I find talk shows quite nerve-wracking when there's a live audience because it's not quite on your terms.
Yeah.
With stand-up, you sort of, you know, you keep working stand-up until it's right, and then you'll take it on tour or something. But with a talk show, you're someone might interrupt or, I don't know, you're sort of in front of the live audience and you're expected to be funny, but it's not quite, you're not like, you don't go, Graham, be quiet, I'm going to do 5 minutes of material.
Oh, God.
You know,
it's so true. It's like if you're on a date and, you know, you're getting to the best bit of your story and the waiter.
And then the waiter shows up.
Yeah. Everything okay here? It's fine.
Yeah.
But you've got
you utter.
Mate.
Aaron Sorkin, will you fuck up? I am trying to tell an anecdote.
But you've got to feel that if you're next to, you know, Margulies on the Norton sofa, you've got to think, well, park all those anecdotes.
Well, also when it's a Margulies, you've just got to, you know, she's going to rule the roost, isn't she? So you're playing second fiddle.
Can I tell you what's happened with Miriam Margulies? A friend of mine's really good mates with her and gave me her email, and we had a back and forth about doing this. I shouldn't tell you this because you'll just think, well, what if she's not doing it? Why am I doing it? But it ended with me saying, so, I mean, that's the plan. Would you like to do it? And she just replied saying, I'm sorry, Tom. I do not want to do your podcast. Just thought.
Oh, wow.
I thought, lovely. No, I appreciate that.
Yeah. Is it too late for me to bail now?
Absolutely
not. Is it
too
late to do Margulies?
Hey, I've got 20 minutes out of you. You can go now. It's fine. There's got to be at least two clips for Insta.
What's the budget history of this jokester? Stay tuned for my mate bought a toaster.
Okay, look, let's crash on through now, Steve. We're in 2000 and... Let's go to 8. David Essex double bill. David Essex.
Well, now, this was because, again, this was because we, Ricky and I, made a film set in the 70s called Cemetery Junction. And yes. So I think we're probably watching movies made in the 70s to just help us with the... Again, not with the ideas as much as the... The visuals, like what did it look like?
Yeah. On the buses, mutiny on the buses.
Well, there you are.
Well,
you couldn't get a more 1970s show than on the buses, and just the way the city looks and the clothes and the whole thing.
So when you're writing that with him, would you have sat with him and you've gone, that's good? That, like, are there specific little things, or do you just sort of watch it in your own time and do you know what
I
mean?
Yeah, I think that's it. You'd come back and go, oh, this might be interesting, or this is a visual. Visual cue, or this is something like that. Because yeah, whenever you're doing anything kind of period, there's always that feeling of it's tricky, isn't it, with period stuff, because you want it to feel authentic to the moment. Mm. But if it was too authentic to the 1971 England, it would just be bleak and grim. You wouldn't want to see it.
You know, also comedically problematic as well.
Yes. So, oh, God, yeah.
Problematic on every level. Yeah. You just have to take the icing, right? But not the whole cake, I guess. Just
well, the opening of Holiday on the Buses, I still remember, because they're reversing one of the buses. It hits a bus shelter, I think. What I think you'd term a dolly bird is running towards the bus and her blouse just falls open.
Oh.
And that's in the first... Oh, that's why he crushes the bus into the bus shelter.
Well, of course.
And then the credits start. That's pre-credits.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine writing that on your script? Page
and remember... but remember, Mutiny on the Buses, I think the most successful... Either Holiday on the Buses or Mutiny on the Buses, the most successful film that year. It beat the James Bond film of that year in the British box office.
Wow.
Which meant that Reg Varney was more popular than Sean Connery in 1972.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Bigger than Bond, mate. Bigger than Bond.
Right. There you go.
Okay, look. 2011 now, Stephen Merchant. And look, you can have all sorts of success, but fundamentally... we are all, as British people, comedically imprinted on some level by Noel Edmonds. And that's clear on the 8th of December 2011 when you bought the Mr. Blobby costume - men's.
Yes, it is a Mr. Blobby costume. I wish I could say that that was for one of my own sort of private sex parties. But
of course,
the truth is that was a gift to a friend.
Okay.
Big Blobby fan.
Right, yeah. Right. And so, do you know if they wore it? I mean, is it weird to follow up the gift? I always feel with gifts that I'm quite needy and I want to sort of get a... Do you know what I mean? Just feedback a few months later. Hello, mate, just so you know. Not just a thank you card, but like a proper, here's what I've done with the book, or here's where I read this, or here's where I wore the costume.
Oh, you're needy in that way, I see.
Yeah,
yes.
I think
I'm quite happy to send it off into the ether, and any kind of photo or thank you is really just a bonus for me. But certainly, although that Blobby costume was a gift, I was and remain a big Edmonds fan.
Big.
Noel Edmonds, big kind of... He was sort of like the older big brother I never had when I was young and he was on TV.
Yeah.
And later in life, I remember once when I first started working at the BBC, I walked past Edmonds, and Edmonds was quite officiously walking along in a briefcase. I thought, there's a guy. There's a light entertainer with a briefcase. Wow. This guy is taking care of business.
Yes.
And later, when he came back and he did Deal or No Deal, I was absolutely dazzled by the fact that that man could spin out... for an hour at a time, with almost a sort of mystical energy, the opening of random boxes. I mean, that there's a level of skill to keep talking for an hour every day, which is just, Marjorie, what are you thinking about this box? What are you thinking now? Tell me what you're thinking.
Yeah.
And it was just, I mean, there's a skill to that, a broadcasting talent, which on the surface looks easy. But my God, you try and go on. You're an experienced broadcaster, Tom, but you go on and just... talk to people about opening fucking boxes.
I mean, honestly,
it's extraordinary.
Mate, they even made it into a board game. Imagine that for Christmas. No, don't open the board game. Don't open the box. We're just going to talk about it.
Well, funnily enough, I remember bizarrely being in Rio with some friends, and it was at the height of Deal or No Deal success, and we concocted our own version.
Oh, yeah.
And you realise quite quickly that without Edmunds, it's not a very exciting game.
Yeah. Some shows. It's really a Did very you tell dull. Me you flew Edmunds out to Rio? That would be a call, wouldn't it?
Stephen just Merchant got him here. On a FaceTime.
But it's incredible. It's the Schrodinger's cat of formats, because it's all happened.
Yes.
It's done.
That's right. That's it.
So exactly. Why are we here? Like, it's incredible. Yeah. It's
absolutely.
Massive.
Oh, but actually, they've revived it, and I was watching it the other night, and I don't get as animated about anything than when I'm watching Deal or No Deal. I get furious. I mean, I'm screaming at these people. Take the money. That's a year's wages, you prick. I get furious.
I love it. But
I get very invested in, for some reason, in the random opening of boxes.
I know why you're invested, because I know this about you. You're not a sporty guy. You're not into your sport. This is your sport. It's what it is.
It is. But it's the same enthusiasm that I think you see people have, the same passion that people have for sport.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And I feel that same way when I'm shouting at some truck driver because he's just turned down 24 grand from the banker.
Instead of the referee's a wanker, the banker's a wanker. That's what you're doing.
Well, actually, it's not the banker I have the issue with. It's some of these contestants who... It's when they've got some kind of spiritual bullshit that they're depending on.
Uh-huh.
Or when one of the other people stood behind, you know, one of the boxes says, I've got a good feeling about this one, Clive. Oh, no, you haven't got any feeling. It's just a box.
Fate is already written, mate. It's already done. Just to circle back to Edmunds. I know he may have said a few controversial things over the years, Steve, and he does have something of the UKIP Fathers for Justice sort of fury about him, right? And I'm not going to judge that.
Undoubtedly.
But
like with Picasso, yeah. I can detach the man from the art.
There you go.
I've got that ability.
Yeah, definitely. And he used to, when my first TV presenting job, I was produced by Andy Peters, no less, and he used to talk about Edmunds all the time because... Noel Edmunds would be in rehearsing. Maybe this is a work ethic you'd have as well with writing stuff, but Edmunds would be there. He'd be the first guy on set. You hear this about footballers, don't you? The first one's on the pitch, the last one's off. First one on set, he's doing a bit involving the audience. He's learning it all. He's got his cards. He learns. He puts the cards away every single time. Noel's house party was not a thrown together, you know, bit of luck.
You see, now I'm interested to you say that because when I first began in this business, there was this sort of illusion, this myth, which perhaps... I don't know where it got it from, but this idea that if you tried too hard, if you practiced, it suggested a lack of sort of innate talent, right? The idea that, you know, you should just, you know, we imagined that Robin Williams just went on stage unprepared and was so brilliant.
Yeah.
It all just came flowing out. And maybe that was true, maybe it wasn't. But there was the idea that you sort of, that, you know, innate talent, innate genius just meant that you just went and did it.
Yeah.
And then you realize over time that all the greats, Edmunds, Eric Morecambe, they put the work
Price.
In. You know, they rehearse and rehearse. Price, they rehearse to the point where it looks unrehearsed. And that is something I now, like I mentioned with the talk shows, you know, I'll put the work in so that I'm sort of prepared so that when, you know, Jimmy Fallon says, so tell me about your recent holiday, I'm not fumbling around for an answer.
No, save that for podcasts.
Exactly.
That must be, I mean... Can you imagine doing a Fallon with no answers? So, Steve, I hear you like trains recently.
No, I don't actually, Jim. No, I haven't been on a train for years.
It would be a great April Fool's to play on Fallon, to do a whole episode with super, super, superstar guests who've got nothing.
They've got nothing.
Just nothing. I'd love that.
Yeah.
Where we're going, we'll be showing that we're losing the toes. Cause these lovely ass people gonna talk to the host.
He's gonna ask a couple questions.
What they're buying the most. Cause one man got down just like a piece of toast.
30th of November 2012 now, Steve. You bought the X Factor portable karaoke machine because if there's one thing about karaoke that I don't like, it feels very anchored to a room. But you've gone portable. You spent £85. You can take that absolutely anywhere. And that is... It's a microphone attached to a speaker. That's what it is. That's speaker's corner. It's singer's corner.
Again, I wish, without wishing to, this feels a little bit like what we were just saying. This is a Fallon situation where you've brought up the karaoke machine, hoping that I'll tell you now about my passion for karaoke.
So when you bumped into Adele, go on.
Yeah, truth is, I can't bear karaoke. And that was a gift for someone else because I detest karaoke for several reasons. Mm. One, like we were just saying, I admire people that put work in and are good at something.
Yeah, yeah.
Whether it's singers, comedians, whatever.
Yes.
And I don't want to see me or anyone else who is a sort of rank amateur with a bad or middling singing voice ruining Living on a Prayer. I would rather see, I'd rather watch an old John Bon Jovi YouTube clip than hear you doing your shitty version of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so either you've got just mediocre people and then one person who's normally the person who suggested we do karaoke because they're really good. And it's not enjoyable to me. I want performances to be good. I would rather pay money and go and see a concert with a great talent. I don't want to see you doing your shitty version of a song.
I think the unsaid truth about karaoke is the worst thing about it is being the person in the booth who's not singing. What am I meant to do? Well, hey, do I dance? It's like being stuck in a lift with someone auditioning for the X Factor.
How many times have you been in a pub? There's a karaoke. There's someone up there singing, and all that anyone else is doing is just looking through the booklet
to decide
their song.
Yeah, yeah.
And no one's paying any attention. And it's just, I find it insufferable.
I'm sorry
if you're a karaoke fan or if you're running a karaoke boutique.
Listen,
but it's not my thing.
It's that you're allowed to not have your things. And, you know, there are other things that you can have. There are other passions you can have. Steve, 29th of November 2012, you spent £190 on the Allergy Solution HEPA 55281 bagged cylinder vacuum cleaner. It's a lovely Hoover. Really, really nice.
Let me tell you what happened there, mate. I discovered I was allergic to my flat.
No.
Couldn't figure out what the problem was, but I did a lot in the next couple of years to try and not just have eyes streaming, sneezing every time I entered my flat.
Were you living inside a cat? What do you mean? What was it?
Well, that's what it felt like. Honestly, it was brutal. I mean, I'd go away on holiday, I'd come back, and within an hour, I'd be sneezing, my eyes would be streaming.
It's dust.
I had allergy dust? People came by. Well, this is why I had these Hoovers and things. They were spotlessly cleaned, the whole house. I had allergy people come round. To do tests on whether there was too much dust.
Allergy exorcists,
they couldn't find anything. And at one point I thought, well, maybe it's me, maybe I'm the problem. I said to someone, do you got any ideas for any tips on allergy specialists? And they gave me a number and I went to this guy and it was a Harley Street, what I can only describe as a Harley Street quack.
Okay.
And I was so furious and I got there and I thought, hang on a minute, this is not a proper clinic. Because he had like in a sort of attic room, and he had these little sort of jars of things, and each of them would say things like apple, dust, cats, cheese. But the thing was, it's just a mistake. He said to me, "So I understand you've got allergy problems." I said, "Yes, I have." He went, "Do you know what allergies? You know what kind of allergies?" I said, "Well, I think maybe dust." He went, "Interesting." And then when he got out his dust jar.
Yeah.
Of course, true enough, that was the one that suddenly informed him that I was allergic to dust. I think I had to hold it or sniff it or something. And he went, "Oh yeah, dust is a problem." And I just wish I hadn't told him that dust was the issue. I wish I'd said, "Well, you tell me." But I remember at one point he was doing some kind of bullshit test on me that I knew was crap.
Yeah.
And I remember looking out of his window like Bruce Forsyth on The Generation Game into his own camera and kind of rolling my eyes as if to say, if anyone's watching this, I know this guy's a lying piece of shit and I'm not falling for it, but I'm here now and I'm just trying to be polite. I was so furious with him.
You were playing to an imaginary camera just in case.
Yeah, but anyway, it subsequently turned out it was the mattress.
The mattress.
The mattress was the issue. And once I finally got rid of that mattress and changed it, I was off to the races. Life was never the same again.
You got to spend big on a mattress. Was it an old mattress?
I'll tell you what it was. I think it was one of those, it was like a knockoff version of one of those Tempur-Pedics. It wasn't the Tempur-Pedic, it was a knockoff version. And I think it basically had started to disintegrate.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, you're a self-employed writer. You spend a lot of time in bed. That is what it is.
A lot of time in bed.
It's overuse.
You know, that bed saw a lot of action in 2012. And had to get rid of it.
God, what a moment, though. What a moment to work out what that is. That's a proper sort of Knives Out mystery.
Yeah.
That is the sort of mystery thriller I'd like. Like House, like Hugh Laurie's in House. Just trying to work it out, but a slightly mundane end. I'd enjoy that.
Yeah. Oh, well, it's just a word of advice for anyone who perhaps has similar issues.
Yeah.
And they can't identify the source. Just think about your mattress, guys.
Or There's a great doctor called...
There's a great guy in Harley Street.
Yeah, Dr. Donald Duck, I believe his name is.
Exactly.
28th of November 2012, you spent £9.63 on a British Airways Boeing 747 toy. You weren't doing that well. You weren't making Hollywood money yet, but you did buy a plane, but it was a toy.
I bought a toy plane, but do you know what that was? That was a little gift to give to my parents because at the time I was doing quite a lot of work in the US. Uh-huh. And I wanted to fly them out, and so they, because I don't think they'd been to Los Angeles, and I thought that, you know, my dad was a big movie lover, is a big movie fan, and I think that idea of coming to see the Hollywood sign and the whole thing, always very exciting. And so I flew them out, and I'm pretty sure I flew them business, because I remember, and I sort of gave this to them as a little gift to say, look, you know, when you're ready, come out, I'll pay for it, come out to the States. Yeah. And but I remember they went business and they, not first, I've not made money.
Yeah, of course.
And they landed, they arrived at the flat I was in or the house I was in. And my mother said, oh, it was good. It was good. Business class was good. We got to leave the plane before the ordinary people.
Oh, how quickly.
And I just thought, how quick people change. Yes. Wow. Yes. God, she never looked back.
The class system is just dormant in all of us, isn't it? Waiting.
Just waiting. Yeah. There's a woman who, you know, my father was a plumber and a builder.
Yeah.
She was one of the ordinary people, but no longer.
You should have sent her back in economy.
Teach her a lesson.
Teach her a lesson. That must have been a lovely moment. Yeah. That must have been amazing to take your parents out. Look at me now. Because by this point, right, has the office been bought in America and you're doing movies? Like, the merchant has gone big here, right? Not just 6'7" big, but
yes, I think maybe I was even doing the Hello Ladies TV show.
Yes.
And so yeah, it was just a fun thing to be able to do. And I think we did some of the studio tours, you know, and but then they came to some set. We had probably some film sets and they came to that or whatever it was. It was just nice to be able to share that stuff. And I think again, because a lot of my love for comedy, film, entertainment is through watching it with my dad, you know, and that when other people were out kicking a ball around, whatever it was, no, me and my dad just sat with the curtains drawn on a summer's day watching an old Lauren Hardy film.
That's beautiful.
So it was quite nice to be able to go out and sort of see the sights and, you know, experience a bit of that.
Look what's beyond the curtains, Dad. Look what I've done, Dad. Did you get a moment? I always wonder how I'd feel about this. If my mum ever says she's proud of me, I don't know what to say. She says it every now and again. I feel it's crushingly awkward. But did you get a moment with your mum and dad by the Hollywood sign saying, well done, son? Was there a little kind of like, or did they play it even cooler and just it doesn't need to be said?
I don't know if it was that particular moment, but I do think that they've definitely said it over the years. Yeah. And I've always appreciated that. But they're not withholding of praise and the way that I know some parents are.
Yeah.
You know, I know that some people are very driven because their father has never given them a pat on the back and said, good job, son.
Yes.
But my parents have always been encouraging and supportive in that way.
Yeah,
they've just always been very cautious about things like pension plans.
Oh, lovely.
You know, so when I said I'm leaving the BBC to write this show called The Office, they went, okay, well, the thing is, if you stick with the BBC, you will have a pension. You could get a pension. There was always the concern was just have something to fall back on.
Always. That's lovely to hear that they're happy to give out the proud thing. Could I give you your mum and dad my email? Is that okay? There's a few other comics as well. you could offer that as a service. Do you know what I mean?
That's
right. Well done, son. You'd make a fortune.
We like to listen to Toast. And we're not the kind who would boast. And even in spite of the host, we still like to listen to Toast. La, la, la.
September 2014, elsewhere, you've bought the Physio World Foam Roller. I see a lot of these popping up.
Do you? Yes.
Yeah.
Well, you'll notice 2014, that's the year I turned 40.
Right. Okay.
So I think the aches are starting to appear.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll notice there as well. I'm noticing over your shoulder there, 2014, a nose clipper and hair trimmer.
Yeah, you got the Paul Anthony nose clipper, famously hirsute man.
Well, it's just that when you get to 40, it's that I remember someone telling me, I can't forget who it was. It might have been Jonathan Ross, but I can't be sure. So I don't want to credit him if it wasn't him. Yeah. But someone said to me, make sure you get a good nose trimmer if you're going to be on the TV. You know, ears is the ear hair as well as the nose hair. Yeah. You've got to keep on top of that.
It's what God gives you for your 40th. Mm-hmm. Pain and hair, that seems to be the ear hair, especially when you're just, and then you might pluck a few, but then they just keep coming. It's like you're pulling at an infinite thread of them.
That's right. And yeah, the foam roller, I forget exactly what, but there was probably just a little, that lower back, there's something with the lower back. I'll roll you out.
But you're a tall man.
There you are.
You're a tall man. Surely you're going to...
going to run into trouble.
Do you get aches and pains? Are you an aches and pains guy?
I do, but I do work quite hard to try and alleviate them with some exercise and massages and things.
You look after yourself.
Yeah, you heard me.
God.
Some of my purchases, you know, are very kind of, are very much based on trying to stay healthy or alleviate pain.
Yeah. You look after yourself. I remember this when we went on tour together, when you were supporting me going around Iceland and Scandinavia. And I remember you eat well. You're not a sweet tooth guy. You eat. No. You look after yourself.
I try to. Yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
I'm proud of you, son. Just want to say, done so well.
It's nice to hear. It is nice to hear.
Yeah. But do you know what? It's such a long-term investment. You know, I can't be bothered to even think about a pension, right? But you are on a daily basis controlling, you know, don't have those, don't eat that or whatever, just in a tiny bit. But over time, mate, when you get to 50, 55, 60, you're going to be laughing, honestly.
I am. I'm trying to invest in health and, and put my money in sensible places. Have you topped up your ISA this year, Tom?
Oh, mate, I'm too busy riding the Bitcoin roller coaster. It's absolutely fine. Us tech bros... Yeah, we do any of that.
Sure.
We're fine. We'll be fine. All right. Look, 2018 now, Steve, as we get towards the end of this episode. Loads of very domestic stuff here. So we're looking at shower corner shelf. You've got your decorative freestanding toilet roll. Yeah, nothing decorates a bathroom more than a freestanding toilet roll holder. Decorative is doing a lot of work, isn't it? That word there. Actually, I would say refund issued. Was it used when you sent it back?
Almost certainly not, as far as you're concerned and anyone listening. That was, I think, finally moved from the flat I previously mentioned to a house.
Uh-huh.
And when you move from a flat to a house, you very quickly realize there's a lot of things you don't have.
Yeah.
You think, well, I'll just move all the furniture and spread that around the house. And then, oh no, there's not enough stuff. I've gone from one bathroom to three because I've made a little bit of money now.
Yeah.
I'm going to need some extra bog roll holders.
You're going to be getting so much sympathy from my listeners right now. Oh, mate, it's a nightmare. Those three bathrooms.
It really is.
Why don't people realise?
When you move to the three bathroom place. it's that period where, you've sort of upscaled from kind of bachelor lifestyle.
Yeah.
So... you know, the sort of the large leather sofa that you had doesn't feel somehow right anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
It's time to have a fabric sofa.
Those are the moments, and a lot more cushions. A
lot of cushions. Love a cushion, but I'm quite partial to it. It's not. I'll scatter cushions wherever you want, mate.
When you're sitting on the sofa watching one of your movies, right?
Yeah.
What's your optimum number of cushions?
Well, I like to lie flat. Two cushions behind the head.
Two, okay.
Yeah.
That's it?
Well, where else do I need the cushions?
Well, let me tell you, this could be a game changer for you. Try this out. Please try this out. And if you do it, it's doing a Tom Price.
Yeah.
Behind the head, fine. Pop one or two under your knees.
Well, I think if we got further into the Amazon history, if we had time, you'd find that I actually bought something.
Are you actually?
That was purpose made.
Oh, my God.
In fact, look there, 5th of February, 2022. A wedge pillow, adjustable memory foam, incline cushion system with head support, bed leg rest pillow for sleeping, reading, post-surgery.
Yes.
And acid reflux.
How to do a Tom Price. That's what it says here.
Yeah.
So that is to, because that will optimize your comfort. That will support you across the body if you do that.
Exactly. Arch the legs.
Arch the legs.
Alleviate pain from the lower. Alleviate pain from the lower back. Oh yeah, I'm ahead of you, Mike. But you see, again, I don't wish to seem gauche, but I'm not just using a couple of pillows. I'm buying a purpose-built artifact
for £68. That is a £68 pillow. Oh God, that's good.
£68 worth of comfort. There is no price you can put on comfort.
That's just there isn't. There really isn't. There really is. It's a beautiful thing. All right, look, we're getting towards the end. We're going to find the last couple of things. 28th of February, 2023. The adjustable kettlebell for £120.
Well, there you go. You see,
and wow, look at this. You got your 3-in-1 refillable mega tank inkjet printer for £450. He's spending big on the 28th of Feb. That was a big day, that.
That was a big day, wasn't it?
Payday. It's payday, isn't it? It's payday, end of the month.
That's because I'd already been through about three other printers, and I thought, perhaps it's a false economy, these cheaper ones.
Yeah.
Maybe I should splash out here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's over here in the corner. So far, so good, but I don't want to promise anything.
Do you...
I've spent more hours in my life fiddling with fucking printers than anything
the
else.
The worst. When the computer says, can't see printer. I remember... during one of those rages, yeah. getting my laptop and showing it to the printer, because I can't see printer, and showing my laptop the printer.
But you saw the printer 2 hours ago.
Yeah.
We printed earlier.
Yeah.
Why are you not seeing it now?
It happened.
And the thing I hate if it's one about printers is it will say something like, code X14 error.
Yeah.
But it's like, it won't tell you what the error is. It's like it's flirting with you. There's an error. Yeah. Won't tell you what it is. But before that, you've noticed the kettlebell, because again, you've got to invest in fitness.
Yeah. Yeah, you're fighting gravity, Steve. You're picking things up, you're putting them back down again. I love a kettlebell. How often do you use the kettlebell?
I try and use that a couple of times a week.
Nice.
Because it was very much a post-COVID thing.
Yes.
Was trying to do more at-home exercise
during
the pandemic. And so I thought, actually, I've come off the other side of that. Let me invest in a couple of select items.
And you don't want to go to a gym. You can't be 6 foot seven Stephen Merchant off of the telly in a gym. That's not going to happen, is it? Surely.
I like a gym, but it was more, if I can get a little bit of this done at home, then that maximizes more time for arguing with my fucking printer. That's the 2 hours that I spent trying to find it, connect it through Bluetooth or whatever, because I didn't have to travel to a gym.
It's the sort of the relationship we have with our printers is sort of very Steptoe and Son, just sort of where it's a sitcom in its own right, trapped together. We both need each other. Neither of us want each other, but we're stuck. We need it.
And they don't realise that we're in an increasingly paperless age.
Right. Yeah.
They should be sweet with us.
They
should really be trying hard.
Yeah.
They and whoever's creating them, building them, should really be, they should be making life a lot easier for us.
Yeah, there's an existential threat to you. It's called the cloud,
mate. They don't seem to care. There's an arrogance to the printer.
Megatank. Also, it's called the Megatank. Please tell me you call it the Meg. Look, Steve, we've run out of time, and we've got to the last few items that you've bought. And as ever on the show, what we're going to do is very much tell the story of Stephen Merchant in the last couple of items, all right? Now, we know you're super busy. Outlaws Season 3 is out now. It's so good. I love that show so much. Just congratulations on it.
Thank you.
But $23.99, you might be writing absolutely top comedy. Is it a comedy thriller? Is that what we'd call it? A thromedy?
A comedy thriller.
But the real peril, the real jeopardy, comes when you buy the Yoga Medic toe separator for overlapping toes. That's is where you're going to go on a hell of a roller coaster ride right there.
This is something recently introduced to me by my partner, Marseilla. She said that as you get older, your toes start to fold over each other.
Wow.
And I don't know if there's any truth in that.
I'm terrified.
Because she is quite susceptible. She's quite susceptible. So it's sort of Instagram, you need this in your life.
Yeah.
But yes, so anyway, the two of us, we've got his and hers. pop them on your toes of an evening, and they spread your toes apart in an effort to stop them overlapping as you get older. You've got to keep the magic alive, Tom.
I love the domesticity of it, that you're starting this episode buying DVDs and watching long form dramas and working out what kind of writer you're going to, where you're going to go, and at the end. Good night, darling. Have you done your toes? No, I must. Hang on 1 second. I just got to go and do my toes. And when you walk with them, you must make a real sort of flap, like a platypus flap.
Exactly. But I'm not walking through, I don't know, cement. I'm not going to leave a sort of creepy footprint behind. Yeah, but no, you're right. They are, listen, I'll let you know in a couple of years if they've...
Yeah.
We'll compare toes, Tom, in a few years' time, and we'll see who's...
Yeah.
We'll see who's walking and whose feet look the nicest.
As sign-offs go, you're securing your future on OnlyFans for the foot people. That's the first thing to say. And as sign-offs go, thanks, Stephen Merchant. Good luck with Outlaws Series 3 and good luck with your toes. That's a great sign-off.
It's a beautiful sign-off. You've ended far better than you began.
Story of my life. Stephen, you're absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much for doing the show. It was lovely to catch up with you. Thank you, mate.
Cheers, mate. Thank you, Tom.
That's it. I'm emotional. You're emotional.
you've completed Series 8 of My Mate Bought a Toaster. If you have just jumped on for the Stephen Merchant giggle train, hello and welcome, and thank you so much for dropping by. There's loads of other episodes, like over 120 episodes of this podcast. Tim Key, Adam Buxton, oh gosh, endless names that are all blocking in my brain. Anyway, have a look and dig in and help yourself to all the old episodes that are there. That's it for this series. We'll be back again later on in the year. There's going to be some live dates. If you'd like to come see the show live, then we are going to be doing it at the Hen and Chickens Theatre, the 8th and 22nd of September. It's a lovely little space just by Highbury and Islington Tube Station in that London town. So if you're around that area and you'd like to drop in and see the show done live, then we'd love to have you there. That's the 8th and 22nd of September at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are £10, or if you are a Patreon member, then they're free. That's right. You can go to patreon.com/toasterpod. For as little as £3 a month, you can sign up and see all the extra bonus footage. There's loads of other stuff from this interview with Stephen. You can watch the whole thing, I believe, on our YouTube page, youtube.com/@mymatebought a toaster. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram @toasterpod. Oh, that's a lot of admin and facts, isn't it? Which is no way to end such an emotional roller coaster of a series. This has been a great series. I'd like to say thank you hugely to my brilliant producer, Heather Davis. She's amazing. And if you are looking for a great podcast producer, she's freelance. She's not available because I want her working on this show, not yours. Very important to say that. Thank you to the brilliant Jack and Katie for doing all the bits and bobs on the filming for the series. And thank you, as ever, to the brilliant Gramercy Park Studios, who so often let us use their studios. But most of all, thank you so much to, well, obviously you, the listener, but thank you to me, Tom Price, for hosting this for no money at all. Just pure self-indulgence has driven me up to this point. All right, see you later in the year. Lots of love. It's my mate, oh, toaster. Oh, oh. It's my mate, oh.